Hello, and welcome back to the Offspring Magazine, the podcast. It's Bea, and I will be hosting today's podcast. Today will be part one of our conversation with Professor Peter Zeberga, who is one of the directors at the MPI of Colloids and Interfaces in the Department of Biomolecular Systems in Potsdam. Today's conversation will focus on Professor Zeberga's research on carbohydrate-based vaccines. We talk about what carbohydrate-based vaccines are, how they work, and what is their potential. We also talk in detail about the challenges of making carbohydrate-based vaccines and the contributions that Professor Zeberga has made to the automated synthesis of carbohydrates and how this has advanced the field. With that, I hope you will enjoy this episode. Hello, Professor Zeberga. Thank you so much for joining today. Why don't we just start, as per usual, with probably every interview that you do, just introduce yourself to the audience.
My name is Peter Zeberga. I'm a chemist and biochemist, and right now I'm a director of Max Planck Institute for Colloids and Interfaces here in Potsdam.
Nice. So what do you research?
The focus of my research for the past, 27 years now is sugars. My group works on carbohydrates, but not the short ones you put in your tea or coffee, but we are more interested in the oligo and polysaccharides that surround all of the cells of humans, but also bacteria and parasites.
Yeah. I mean, actually, just walking around the Institute, I saw your research group is huge. So you have like a lot of different research groups, but one is focused on making carbohydrate-based vaccines.
So our department here is a lot of younger people that work for the most part on their own. I still direct two research groups that are a total of about maybe 25 to 30 people. And one is automation and one is called vaccines. And that also basically goes to the base of what we do. I think my claim to fame is basically the idea of using solid phase synthesis to make oligo and polysaccharides. And that idea actually I had as a PhD student because I got my PhD in the United States working for Marvin Caruthers. Marvin Caruthers developed the automated synthesis of DNA and of RNA. And since we are three biopolymers that are the basis of all of life, oligonucleotides store the genetic information via RNA that goes to peptides and proteins, and they then make in turn carbohydrates. And Bruce Merrifield in the 60s developed automated peptide synthesis. Caruthers in the 80s and the 90s developed DNA and later on RNA synthesis. And so as a PhD student, I realized, okay, there's a third one, and that's carbohydrates. And so I wanted to develop automated carbohydrate synthesis, not knowing that it's a lot more complicated. But basically now, 27 years later, we realized, okay, this actually can be done and we can make really, really long structures.
So you started off first with the idea of you want to have an automated system to make carbohydrates, and then you kind of got into this field of carbohydrate-based vaccines.
Exactly. So the idea was, if you can make a molecule, then there are things you can do afterwards.
Yeah.
The same was true in DNA too, right? If you can make a primer, you can do PCR. So I think as a chemist, I realized that first of all, we got to make things. And as a PhD student, as I said, I realized that I wanted to make oligosaccharides. And what I did is I did a postdoc in the lab of Sam Danishevsky at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And at that time, five postdocs would take 2 years to make a pentasaccharide, so 5 units. And the same actually is true even for DNA 40 years earlier, and for peptides, the same thing. So what we realized is if you want to make it really something people can use, you got to come up with a way to make it faster. And so automation was a way we knew we had to go, but automation sounds just like you're going to whatever, put together a machine, but by the end of the day, it comes down to chemistry, because you're going to have chemical reactions that work really, really well for you automate it. In DNA chemistry, for example, we get 99.99% yield for each linkage. In peptides, similar. And in carbohydrates, we used to have yields of maybe 50 or 60%. And of course, we had to really study the glycosylation reaction, get all that chemistry going, get the protection groups better, get the stereochemistry right, get the regiochemistry right, put all that together. And once the chemistry works, then a machine can do it. But one should not think that a machine can do something that doesn't work for humans, okay? So by machine, by the end of the day, is stupid. It can only do repetitive things. And if those repetitive things work well, when you can use it. So really starting in January 1st, 98, when I started my own group at MIT, what we looked at was glycosylation chemistry. And then luckily the first 3 years, we got things going so well that we could take an old peptide synthesizer that we reconfigured. That's all we could afford at that time. We bought it used. We reconfigured it, and the temperature change was done by a PhD student or me in the lab standing next to it and just basically switching things around. That was a paper in Science that sort of showed people, okay, it can be done. And then slowly we really innovated this entire process. And it was really each time we sort of cleaned out one bottleneck, a new bottleneck started, and slowly can make larger structures. Today, we can make on a machine one go up to 100 mer. That's interesting for material science applications. And so one of the groups in my department today, Martina Del Bianco, she has done a fantastic job in using the synthetic power to make new types of materials. So she can fold carbohydrates, she can create really cool structures. Other people in our department using that for, in the past, have done it for plant carbohydrates. One of my colleagues, now a professor in Vienna, based on that. So basically, we've looked at all this. And in my own group, what I've been interested in from the beginning, basically, was to think about carbohydrate-based vaccines. But what we realized is that automation is going to be key to get to actually solve this problem of carbohydrate-based vaccines. Because what's clear is carbohydrate-based vaccines have been around for a long time. They've been extremely successful. But for the next generation ones we're working on, the synthesis had to be brought under control.
Okay. Oh, I don't even know where to start now. There are so many different questions. But actually, so the first thing I wanted to ask was, how much did you learn from like a peptide synthesizer, DNA synthesizer, to then build your own machine? Because I feel like to a non-chemist, maybe it sounds like, oh, it's kind of the same, but I could imagine that there were things that you learned and then things that maybe you had to reinvent from scratch.
So we wanted to invent as little as possible.
Yeah.
Whatever we can take, we want to copy. So we looked, so what you need to make polymer synthesis, Merrifield showed us that if you take a polystyrene resin, a little plastic bead basically, where a little plastic bead sits on a fritter funnel, so on a filter basically, and all the stuff you don't want, you just wash away. Simple idea, right? I mean, all the things you don't want, you wash away, all the stuff you want is on the bead. For that idea, he got a 1984 Nobel Prize, because in the 60s, that is what he figured out, and that changed the world of how to make peptides. So the beads that he has, the polystyrene, we use the same for carbohydrates. So we didn't have to change that, okay? The linker, we had to change that. So that's the piece that connects the first sugar to the solid support. The sugar monomers that go on, those had been used in solution phase chemistry. Some of them, some things we had to develop new. The big difference between DNA, peptides, and carbohydrates is that both peptides and oligonucleotides, so DNA and RNA, they are linear structures. So there's no branching. In carbohydrates, you have branching, which means we have to put protecting groups in to allow for branching or, in chemical terms, regiochemistry. The second difference is that in DNA and RNA, each linkage is not a new stereogenic center. So that means you don't have to control that. And in carbohydrate chemistry, we have a new stereogenic center, which means you have to exercise stereo control. And from a chemical standpoint, which means we have to have two complicating factors. And that is why when I started, before I started as a postdoc, I talked to somebody at a meeting. This was 1996, 97. I guess this will never work. This is a crazy idea, and you're wasting your time, and you're going to have it's going to be a total disaster. So luckily, it wasn't a disaster. I got tenure at MIT, and we got to work on that, but it was not easy. It took a lot of time, and we had to really develop everything, but we learned whatever we could from DNA and from peptides. The machines themselves, by the end of the day, the early machines were, as I said, all peptide synthesizers, because all it was basically a complicated syringe where you had more or less a device where you could put a bucket if you want, they could put stuff in. The difference in carbohydrates was we also have to adjust the temperature, because DNA and peptide chemistry is at ambient temperature, room temperature. We have to go to very low temperatures. And so we had to actually control the temperature, but all these things are not so difficult to build. But basically we took whatever was out there and adapted it to what we wanted to
do. But there were then quite a few people that said, like, this is never going to work. Because like you said, it doesn't seem like a crazy, like, innovative idea, because you had peptide synthesizer, DNA synthesizer. It seems like
that's why I wanted a PhD. To me, it was obvious. But I think most people said, the carbohydrate chemists at the time said, look, this is very difficult. This is only something for absolute total experts. Non-experts can never do that.
Yeah.
And I said, look, what we need is exactly the opposite. We want to educate others to be able to do all these things. And the only way you're going to do this is if we make it accessible to people. And I think that is something we could show. In the beginning, people said it can't be done. I was in the US at the time. I wrote an NIH grant. And the first grant I put in, they said, oh, this can't be done. This is crazy. This won't work. So it got rejected. Then we showed the preliminary data. We had a science paper. We submitted a science paper. I said, look. And they said, oh, no, it can't be done. No, I don't get funding anymore either. So we never got funding or any of that stuff. And luckily, I got funding for other projects. So I was able to run my group at MIT and Groover Group. It was all good. But my actual core project, the automated synthesis, never got funded, which was actually interesting. It was also one of the reasons when I had the offers to come back to Europe to go to ETH, at a time to consider, okay, my group was extremely well funded. I had 35 people at MIT, but I realized that if you want something really outside the box at that time, it might be more easy at a European institution because you have a sort of base funding where you can do some of the risky projects and get additional funding on top. And of course, Max Planck Society, it's even better because there you get money first, then you better do something good. And if you do something good, you get more money. And so I think that was one of the things I really appreciate about Max Planck Society, of basically having this trust in people and being able to do complicated things.
Yeah. What exactly does the machine do? Just if we want, if you could explain this to non-chemists. Yeah.
So you got to think about a machine. What it does, the entire process is basically you make sure you want to have a little chain of beads, like almost pearls on a necklace or something, and each one of those little pearls is a carbohydrate. So the carbohydrate has to be placed in a particular order and in a particular position. So what a machine does is has in a little vial, it has the little beads with the plastic beads. So that's where the whole pearl chain gets attached. Then the machine will take a dissolved building block of a particular carbohydrate that you know, okay, that's the first one I want to put in there. It gets added into a reaction vial. It waits until it reacts. What you want to have is stuck on a bead, the rest gets washed away. Then there's a so-called deprotection solution, which removes a so-called protective group that opens up one particular position, and you can have multiple positions. Like on my hand here, you can take one off, and that next one, you can then attach it there. And so the machine goes through a cycle that basically consists of coupling, so putting the next sugar in, and from deprotection, which basically means opening up one side. And that all machine does. By the end of the day, the user has to tell the machine the order of building blocks. And that is something we are today also trying to automate, such at some point the machine can tell you, okay, that is what you should be doing. Mm. Today, that is still something the chemist has to say, okay, this is the order of building blocks. I'm gonna do it and basically tell the machine, okay, use building block 5 and 8 and 9 and whatnot. And I think eventually we'd like to have a sort of program that tells the user, okay, if you want to make this molecule, that's how you're going to do it. That part is not yet automated.
Okay, but we decide, so you decide what building blocks get put together and in what order.
Exactly.
And you do that based on what you want the end, like
exactly. The
goal kind of, or the, what you want the molecule to do. Because probably if you put them in different orders, they'll have different functions, right?
Exactly.
And I think, then you want the machine to actually tell you what molecules you should be making.
That is something that we would love in the end. The issue of carbohydrates is a little bit complicated. As I said, carbohydrates are branched, and we do not know how they fold. What we do know is carbohydrates also fold. There's this whole dogma where people say carbohydrates don't fold. That is not true. Some carbohydrates don't fold, and they do that because they have certain reasons not to do that. And there are other things, for example, cellulose, that they form structures. So some of them will form helices, and some others will also aggregate into fibrils. And that's why trees stand up outside, because actually we have cellulose fibers that come into play. And so currently what we are doing in my department here is we are very interested in trying to understand the very fundamentals as to how do carbohydrates fold, why do they assemble, and how they assemble in nature to make structures that are important. Because if you think about it, trees can stand up over 100 meters tall in some cases for a very long time. Animal shells, chitin, is also a carbohydrate. So these carbohydrates actually have structural roles. In other areas, for example, in virology, HIV virus, on its surface has a lot of mannoses, another kind of carbohydrate, and those do not fold. And the reason is that they want to basically be almost like leaves in the wind, such that if the immune system comes, it cannot actually recognize the protein. So different carbohydrates have different functions, and based on different functions, will be different sequences.
Yeah.
And all that is something that we really like to understand. In DNA, people realized a long time ago how that works. in peptides also, and in carbohydrates, most of this is basically terra incognita, so unknown area. And this is what I really like to do. And the synthesizer, if you will, was only a tool to make the molecules available that can afterwards be used to open this entire area of carbohydrates. Just a fact, 80% of biopolymer on Earth are carbohydrates by weight. No, because on half is on land, that's cellulose and chitin and other things, yeah. Right? And the other half is in the ocean. And this is something where we're going to go in the future now. We have first people now with Rudi Ammann and Max Planck in Bremen, where we look actually at the carbohydrates in the ocean, because 50% of the carbohydrates on Earth are in the ocean. We are not at all understood. We don't know exactly how they figure in the climate models. What's going to happen as things warm? Are they going to release more CO2? Are they going to capture more? Are we going to be more active? So this is something totally unknown. All I'm trying to say is there are lots of areas in biology, material science, where carbohydrates play a role. And all we did is, I'm just a simple tool maker. I make tools for people that they can use them afterwards and study them. And for myself, I just picked vaccines as one thing I like to do.
No, makes sense. In the machine, you talked about like building blocks being put together. These building blocks, are they carbohydrates that are put together? Or is it like a monosaccharide?
They are monosaccharides. So we usually use monosaccharides. You can also use larger ones if you like. Yeah. But the question is, we have done what we call block couplings to put larger ones together. But we usually don't do that on a synthesizer. You might just do that after the synthesis.
Yeah.
But in principle, we can also do that. But typically, you want to have it broken down as much as possible so you don't have to make oligos. Today, of course, some of my students started a company that is actually offering the building blocks today, because the building blocks take a lot of time to make. And if a company can offer that, of course, that makes a life for PhD students and postdocs easier. And then it's one of those things, in the beginning it's expensive because few people use it, but as more people use it, the building blocks get cheaper. And I give you an example from DNA chemistry. When I started my PhD in 1990, 1 gram of building block in DNA used to cost $100. And today a gram is, I think it's less than $3 in today's dollars, okay, which is even less if you consider this, right? But what it shows is if a lot of people use it, the price goes down because it's just economy of scale, basically. And in carbohydrates, you're a little bit early in that range. So prices are still quite expensive, but it's still cheaper now to buy it than having PhD students and postdocs spending weeks or months making building blocks, because that's scientifically also not very attractive.
Could you build a machine to make these building blocks?
No, right now not. Very clearly. Okay. Unfortunately not, okay?
So that would be really cool if you could combine two machines, one to make the monosaccharides or building blocks and the other one to put them together.
So we are developing some flow chemistry devices, and flow chemistry is one way how to scale certain things cheaper in the area of carbohydrates, but unfortunately no. That would be really nice, yeah.
Okay.
The other thing, of course, we got to say, at some point, maybe down the road, there may be enzymatic systems to make oligosaccharides. Some people work on that. Some people see this as a competition for us. I personally don't think so, because I think there's always going to be a use for making synthetic molecules, because we can, of course, make atomic changes. We can put non-natural fluorine or something into certain places. Others cannot do that. And I think if somebody can do it enzymatically and make it cheaper, hey, fantastic, okay? So I think one shouldn't play these two against each other. I think they're both complementary.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of science like has to be complementary as well. Otherwise, progression will just happen so slowly. And that's not what anyone wants. Right. Okay, let's maybe talk a little bit about vaccines. Yeah. So I guess we've described what a carbohydrate is, because it's just monosaccharides that are put together to form a larger structure. What are vaccines and how do they work?
So vaccines in general, the idea is very simple. You're going to somehow teach your body to recognize an invader that's foreign to your body and maybe causes harm. But invader could be a bacterium, could be a virus, it could be a parasite. And what you're going to do is you're going to somehow teach your body to recognize it. How do you recognize somebody else? Usually on the outside, right? How do we recognize an invader? We're going to look at the outside. So the outside of cells are carbohydrates, so-called glycocalyx, that's around every cell, and proteins. And so many vaccines are based on proteins. That's quite common, many of them are commercial. And the second idea was to use carbohydrates as vaccines, to basically say, look, human body, let's make an immune response, typically antibodies, that can recognize the carbohydrates on the surface of a bacterium. So in the late 1920s and early 1930s, groups in the United States looked at actually trying to create the first carbohydrate-based vaccines.
Sorry, when was that?
1920s and 1930s.
Wow.
So 100 years ago.
Wow. Okay.
So the idea was where they realized, okay, carbohydrates are on these different bacteria, and can we make and maybe use them?
Just to put it into perspective, when was the first vaccine created? What year?
Well, a long time ago in China and India, and then there was Jenner, the American and British doctor who used it for smallpox, right?
Yeah.
This is, I think, late 18th century or something, early 19th century. But what they did is they used usually what's called live vaccines, right? For smallpox, they used cowpox.
Yeah.
And that's what we did in India and China even for a longer time before that. They would do that. And basically the idea was that on the surface of these non-lethal infectious agents, there would be things that would also protect you against something harmful. So cowpox, yeah, which are not bad for us, they would protect you from smallpox, which would be hard for us. So that was the idea. Eventually people said, okay, let's go to heat-killed vaccines. So you can have either live weekend vaccines, attenuated vaccines, or you can have killed vaccines. But the idea was always the same. Give a human body something that will stimulate and make an immune response, but not result in disease. So either something that's not harmful to us, something that's weakened, or something that's killed.
Yeah.
The next level that you're going to go to is, okay, can we make a synthetic vaccine? Can we take something that is actually either genetic material, or is it a peptide, or is it a carbohydrate that you can give? And again, that is something, of course, in a peptide field, was much easier to do, because from the 60s on, Merrifield showed us how to make peptide,
yeah,
and so people could think about using peptides. In the carbohydrate field, everything developed using isolated material. So starting in the 30s, then 40s, the first experiments in humans came in the 1940s after the Second World War, mainly in soldiers. People realized that maybe one can experiment using dead bacteria. So if you think about a bacterium, a cell, on the cell surface, there's a particular carbohydrate, so-called capsular polysaccharide in many cases, and these sugars, these complex carbohydrates, they are specific to a particular type of bacterium, even to a particular strain. They are also different on human cells. For example, a cancer cell will have a different carbohydrate from a healthy cell,
huh,
which of course gets you a lot of interest, because you can say, okay, and I vaccinate people against cancer. And this is why I did my postdoc at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, because this is when they already start thinking about this in the 90s, okay? So we're talking about now 25 years
ago. Yeah.
So, but let's talk about bacteria for now.
Yeah, we'll talk about cancer after.
Exactly. And so basically what happened then in the 60s, 70s, and so on, people said, okay, let's try to make an immune response in humans. And for that purpose, we're going to do is we're going to grow bacteria. We're going to take a polysaccharide from the surface and isolate that. That sounds really simple, right?
Yeah.
Some bacteria don't like to grow, right? So that's the first problem.
Yeah.
Some don't like to grow. Others don't like to necessarily make it so easy for you to actually purify the carbohydrate. Some carbohydrates are not super stable. So there are all these issues. But that was more or less a situation where in the 60s people realized, okay, we can take a polysaccharide, so just a carbohydrate from bacterium, I can inject it, and in you and in me will be okay. The problem is what they realized is that carbohydrates are not really immunogenic in small children under the age of 2.
Okay.
And they are not really immunogenic in people above about 65, 70. Why is that? The reason is probably that carbohydrates play a very important role during development. So during embryonal development, there are carbohydrates that sort of make sure that certain cells go to certain parts of your body. And so it would be not really advantageous if you make a good immune response against carbohydrates. And so in small children, that's one explanation, okay?
That was actually one of my questions, because I read online that the immune response for antibodies is weaker, but especially it's weaker for like children under the age of, well, you said 2, and then for immunocompromised and the elderly as well.
The elderly is clear, because the immune system goes down.
Why?
The immune system in the elderly goes down as we're aging, our immune system becomes less efficient. So I think that is to be expected. Immunocompromised, same situation, right? You have to recognize that.
Yeah.
Now, what people realize then is that what you really want is a T cell dependent response. And carbohydrates are typically not T-cell epitopes. So what you do need is you need a piece of protein or peptide.
Mm-hmm.
And what they then did is they made so-called conjugate vaccines. When I say they, this is typically pharmaceutical companies from about the 1980s on. People started to look into that. So in the 60s, already polysaccharides started to occur. But then they started to have a so-called conjugate vaccines. The idea was to say, okay, let's take a protein, but it's going to be recognized bioimmune system. It's going to lead to a very strong immune response. But on that, we chemically conjugate a carbohydrate. And the immune system is going to see chopped pieces of protein plus carbohydrates, and it's going to make an immune response against the protein, but also against the carbohydrate. So okay. What they did is, as carriers, they used at that time diphtheria toxoid or tetanus toxoid. And diphtheria and tetanus are vaccines which we are getting as kids already.
Yeah.
And so you're basically giving that one more time. But in this case, with a carbohydrate, your body recognizes that, makes a strong immune response, and also is going to protect against the carbohydrate. And this is now on the market since the 1990s. The first vaccine in humans to be used was against Haemophilus influenza type B. It's a mouthful. We call it HIB, H-I-B. And Haemophilus influenza type B used to kill millions of children every year. Very, very big problem. Ever since this vaccine is being used, and it's unfortunately today used not in all countries, in many countries, but it's relatively expensive. In those countries that use the vaccine in children, we basically see no more deaths. It's completely gone. And in developing countries that don't use a vaccine, it's a little problem.
What is this against? You said influenza?
It's a bacterium. It's called Haemophilus influenza type B. So influenza is...
That confuses me, because I'm like, influenza is a virus. No. Well, here we're talking about a bacteria.
It's a bacterium, but the name of a bacterium is called Haemophilus influenza type B. It's complicated, right?
We have
Haemophilus, we have Streptococcus, we have different types of bacteria.
Yeah.
That's a bacterium. With a carbohydrate on top, okay? So that was the first one in the 90s. Even to this day, these are blockbuster vaccines. They still sell over $1 billion in revenue each year. Our kids get it. It's great, okay? What we have to do in the future is we have to make sure that more kids get it. Part of the problem is that the current vaccine is a little bit labile. It's not very heat stable. The carbohydrate can degrade. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons, because the cold chains can be problematic. So we are working on solutions, chemical solutions, actually, to this problem, which I think we have solved now. But in the mid-90s, then came a wave of conjugate vaccines against lung disease, against pneumococci. So Streptococcus pneumonia is the leading cause of death. Actually, it kills more children in Africa than malaria and HIV. So that's pretty serious.
Yeah.
It kills a lot of old people in developed countries. And there was a product that came out in the mid-2000s by two companies had vaccines. One was Pfizer that had Prevnar, and one was Synflorix by GSK. And these vaccines became very famous during the COVID pandemic again, because many COVID patients did not actually die from COVID. They actually died from a bacteria, because what happens is your immune system is, well, you're under attack, basically, right? And then these bacteria grow up, and then the bacteria will kill you. So this is why many people get vaccinated, and the companies that made those, they had revenues for just these vaccines in excess of $6 billion per year. So these are very, very large markets. So what it shows, and it's important, because I think for a long time, people in the vaccine field said, vaccines are great, they save a lot of lives, but they make no money for the companies. And if the companies cannot recoup their very, very high development cost, then nobody would develop anything. And because of the Prevnar franchise for Pfizer that made so much money, I think it became clear to people is, okay, vaccines can be good business. And by the end of the day, I think that's good, because that means more vaccines are being developed, more people are being protected, and I think that's what we want.
Yeah, 100%.
So the issue of Prevnar is, however, that there are at least 95 serotypes. So there are basically the Streptococcus pneumonia, but then there are these different types. And the different types have different carbohydrates on their surface. Mm-hmm. So Prevnar, the first one, was a smaller one. Prevnar 7 then came out, and then Prevnar 13 with 13 serotypes, and that's what's used today. And right now they're gonna go to 20 serotypes. But each time you are putting that vaccine in, then what happens is the bacteria hang in your nasopharynx, so basically around your nose and in the vicinity. But what you do is you basically make sure that those serotypes don't kill people anymore. But these other remaining 80 plus serotypes, hey, fantastic, more space for us. So let's go in. We call that scientifically serotype replacement. And because serotype replacement, there's always a need to develop new vaccines in this area. And as I said earlier, some of the carbohydrates don't like to be purified. It's a very expensive process. It's a very lengthy process. I think the production of Prevnar is the most complicated drug development process, because they have to purify basically before 13, now we're going to have to purify 20 different carbohydrates. Production is super expensive. And what we said is, how about if you could just make that antigen, that piece of carbohydrate that we need to mimic the cell surface, if we can make that synthetic. And people said, okay, but synthetic is going to be expensive. It's going to be hard. And it was hard beforehand. But because we were able to automate that process, we made it faster. All of a sudden, we could say, look, the discovery process that you don't just make one, but you make many, many different molecules, used to take so much time. And now all of a sudden, we can make this much faster. We can accelerate this drug discovery process, and we can really screen much faster. And that is why our tool of automated glycan assembly was a basis of what could be done afterwards from a vaccine standpoint. So the first thing was that people said, okay, it's going to take too long. The second thing they said to us is, okay, synthetic is expensive. Isolation is cheap. And that turns out to not be true, because you need so little for a vaccine. In order to vaccinate you, I would need about 5 micrograms. Four micrograms, typically per dose. And even if the carbohydrate itself is relatively expensive to make, the amount you need is so little that today the cost of goods of just for carbohydrate is below 10 cents. Okay, that's not a vaccine, right? That's just part of a vaccine. Yeah. But that means in a vaccine that you can sell for multiple dollars or euros, if you are below 10 cents, it doesn't matter, okay? So that is why today we even think about developing vaccines for animals, because they're so cheap that even in animals, it would make sense.
Because I always heard that vaccines for animals, it's not a big market because animals don't require that many vaccines. And a lot of times, like the vaccines that you use in humans, you can also just use in animals. So why develop different ones?
Right. The problem is that some of the animals have different diseases. For example, streptococcus in humans is called streptococcus pneumoniae. Yeah. In pigs, it's called streptococcus suis. For pigs, streptococcus suis. And the carbohydrates on the surface of these bacteria are totally different. If you want to use the human vaccine, good luck, because it's not the same.
Yeah.
So actually, we just published papers last year where we showed that we actually able to make also the pig vaccines. In principle, that's something that's going to actually go into the patients, I think, this month now. And the advantage varies, but you don't have to do a lot of animal trials. You can actually go directly into the, the animals that you need to go into. For a pig, a vaccine can cost you about €1, I would say. But it still makes sense. For chickens, that's one thing we can't do anything. For chickens, we gotta go below 1 cent, and that's impossible. The reason I'm excited about animal vaccines is that we often forget the fact that we're using so many antibiotics in these farms. And the antibiotics we use, the chances that they're gonna become resistant, it's gonna go over to humans. And if you think of one, one health idea of humans, animals being all in the same place, I think that it makes sense to use vaccines, and that's 100%. Something when you go, just go.
That's actually really cool. I did a podcast about antibiotic resistance about like a couple of months ago, and we specifically spoke about the fact that so many antibiotics are being used in factory farms. So if we can develop vaccines
I think it's cool. Actually, one thing that I would love to do is also fish vaccines, right?
Because
I don't know if you know that, but I think the Gulf of Mexico, they're dumping actually antibiotics with the shovels into the ocean. It's quite disgusting. I think one of the things is really to try to go and bring that out. For us, we developed, of course, first for humans we were working on. The very first things I worked on myself was Leishmania, the parasite, and malaria. And what we realized is malaria is a very difficult field. So we got out of this because it's just very, very difficult from a development standpoint, because you're talking about a very complicated parasite, but also in a developing world, which is something that's very, very hard to deal with. And then you realized that for vaccines, you have to focus probably on markets. Now, there's a market in the first world, because otherwise people are a little bit reluctant to develop it because they really worry about recouping their investments.
Yeah.
Because the clinical trials to run for vaccines, I think the Prevnar vaccine trial, the original ones were 40,000 patients. So these are really, really huge investments, and makes sense that companies want to make their money back, right? So I think that's clear.
Yeah. Well, that's what I worried about with the animal vaccines, that like there's not going to be that much incentive for a company to develop a vaccine.
Oh, these vaccine companies, actually animal vaccine companies, there are some good ones in Germany. There's one actually close to Berlin in Sachsen-Anhalt called IDT, a German vaccine company.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important, and it's going to become even more important as antibiotic resistance is growing. Because I think if we want to get out of this abuse of antibiotics, vaccines is the only alternative we have. And I think the other thing, of course, is the area of companion pets, cats and dogs. There are possibilities we are going there. But for me, it was clear I'd like to work on humans, right? So we worked on more or less any of the nasties. If you go down the World Health Organization list of nasty bacteria, we worked on all of them. And at Max Planck, of course, a good thing is that in my department, we have everything covered from the synthesis, the engineering to make machines, to make molecules, to test the molecules. I have biochemists, immunologists working for me. We have access to animal facilities ourselves here, so we can actually go up to safety level 2 to test this. So we have really everything in one hand. It makes it so much easier. So what we established already over 10 years ago is that we can go very quickly from a synthesis to testing in animals. And we can publish very nice papers. The problem was that we really wanted to go to the next level and actually test this in humans and develop it for use. And that was something within Max Planck, that's not our mission, okay? And that's not what we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But some of my group leaders, postdocs, PhD students, they started a company called Vaxilon. And in 2015, they got 30 million euros to set up this company, which was based out of Switzerland with research facilities here in Berlin. And they were so successful that 5 years later, they sold the company to a company called Idorsia, a very large Swiss company. Mm-hmm. And they have now two of their candidates going to human clinical trial. And one is for Clostridium difficile, and the other one for Klebsiella pneumoniae. Clostridium difficile is an intestinal problem, and Klebsiella pneumoniae is also a lung thing. So very happy they pushed this forward, so they really showed that this can go to human clinical trials, also create a lot of high-paying jobs in Germany. Yeah. I think that showed directly that the investment in science sometimes even directly pays off, that some money flows back. And that's another message I like to always mention to people. Look, yes, Max Planck, we are doing very basic research. I'm interested in glycosylations and carbohydrates. But by the end of the day, this may at some point yield to the creation of value and thereby a return of investment also to the taxpayers.
That's part one. Thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Professor Zeberger's research, you can check out his webpage on the MPI of Colloids and Interfaces website, and you can also follow him on Twitter. And if you like our podcasts, make sure to follow us on our Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram page. Thanks again for listening. Bye! Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhD Net Science Communication Group, known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Serena Frankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Carrizo. If you have any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspring.podcasts@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy. Bye!